We are the Environmental Affairs Board, and you are listening to Green Radio on KCSB 91.9 FM Santa Barbara. Each week, we will discuss an environmental theme through interviews, current events, and discussion.
And we welcome your participation on the show by calling 893-2424.
After starting Green Radio at the beginning of this quarter, I've been talking to just so many people from all over Santa Barbara, from a ton of different organizations that are doing just such fantastic work around the area that I felt like it was necessary to dedicate a show to some of these organizations. And it's just a sampling of these great organizations, but that's what this show is going to be dedicated to, just a bunch of them talking about how they've been helping Santa Barbara County. And we're going to start off with the Student Food Collective, which just began this year on the UC Santa Barbara campus. They have a long way to go and so many plans. So the interview is going to talk a lot about that. And we're also going to talk a little bit about what they've been doing. So here's the interview I conducted with a ton of the different members from the organization. Today I'm here with Andrew Chang and Anthony Rum, the co-directors of the Student Food Collective, as well as Tucker Garrison, the policy coordinator, and Izez, the historian.
Can you guys explain to the listeners who might not know yet what the Student Food Collective is working to do?
The Student Food Collective is a branch of the Cooperative Food Empowerment Directive, and we kind of started this a year ago. We went to the CSSC Convergence, the California Student Sustainability Coalition, Spring Convergence in San Diego, and went to a workshop by the founders of COFED, the Cooperative Food Empowerment Directive, who were offering a workshop and a five-day training for student leaders who wanted to start food cooperatives on their campus. And so we were really inspired, and we came back and started throwing around ideas like, what can we do? We involved the housing cooperatives, a food cooperative, and what we came up with was that we already had a cooperative grocery store, the Ivy Food Co-op, which we all know and love, and that's kind of where all this inspiration kind of came from to start with. And so we looked on campus, and there wasn't a space to start a restaurant. So we wanted to start a food cart, and that's been kind of the Student Food Collective's project until we became involved with Associated Students. But the goal is to create a food cart that serves sustainable, local, ethically sourced, ethically produced food at an affordable price to faculty, staff, and students. It'll be a better alternative to all the fast food we have on campus, because we know that the dining commons are doing a pretty good job already of sourcing locally, sourcing sustainably, sourcing fair trade stuff. But in terms of campus dining, they have to meet a bottom line, because they don't have the dorms providing a certain amount of guaranteed business to them. So they have to meet a bottom line, so that's why we have fast food like Panda Express, Wendy's, Subway brought in here. And so we want to create an alternative that's not only better, but is run by the students, for the community, that involves people to be more connected to what they eat and to be actually actively involved in the food systems on campus and in the community, because Santa Barbara has a really awesome agricultural and food scene.
How many people initially went to the retreat, and then since then, how many people have become a part of the Student Food Collective?
So the initial retreat, well, let me back up about 2 weeks before that. The first group that met was around 10 or 12 people who were just really interested in the idea of starting a food cooperative. And then we got a team of four, myself, Andrew Dunn, Brooke Rorick, and Jake McCollum, who's the current COFED regional coordinator for the South Coast. And so we went to this five-day retreat up in Sebastopol at this crazy place called the Crick House. It's like an organic farm and intentional community. And we learned all sorts of stuff, like business planning, cooperative management, sustainable food systems, and kind of just built a team. And so I guess to answer the second part of your question, over the year since then, we've built up to a 12-person board of directors, and we have around 20 to 25 people at our weekly meetings, and our newsletter goes out to over 200 people.
So I think also in the last year, one of the things that we've realized is, you know, that we knew before that just becomes more and more apparent is how necessary this is. With the food options that are on campus, we really don't want to see this as an alternative, but rather a sensible option and a healthy option. and that there's also been these other branches of Student Food Collective that have come out in terms of our educational mission, because we realize that that's a huge component of educating people about the industrial, you know, agri-food system and about the food they eat and nutrition and health. And, you know, one of the ways of doing that is through media, it's through outreach, it's through, you know, the more traditional modes of education. But another one is simply feeding people. And so some of our members have started a catering arm of Student Food Collective, which is catered the Coastal Fund event, catering Professor David Cleveland's Sustainable Food Conference.
What sort of food are they creating?
They actually have a 5-course dinner prepared that starts with appetizers and ends at desserts, and everything is sourced within a 100-mile radius. It's very strict, and they've made everything homemade, so the ice cream's all made by them. All the sauces are prepared by them, and everything's just delicious. I'm not exactly sure
I think the short answer is that we really don't know what's exactly on the menu tonight or tomorrow night, but we do know it's going to be awesome.
We are building ourselves as an organization, working towards the project of getting the cafe on campus, I mean the cart on campus. And in that process, we met with a lot of administrators, kind of getting their approval, hearing what they had to say. And we met with the executive director, Maricela, of Associated Students, and kind of pitched the idea. And when we were in that meeting, she had already known about us. She knew about CoFed, and she was like, we need you guys. We need a student voice for a cafe that we're trying to start up. And so they kind of asked us to help them form a vision for a cafe they hope to open on Pardal. And so that was, you know, a 2-month process, or a long,
ongoing process.
Still ongoing. Maricela has 2 bosses, one being the AS president elected by us, and the other being Vice Chancellor Young. And so Vice Chancellor Young has already expressed his concerns about the cafe. And so that's one of her bosses. And if the other boss is also not fully on board, she doesn't want to have 2 people against her. So she's just kind of covering her back and saying, you know, I want you to do the research to see if you will approve on it. If you are happy with it, you know, I'll sign it, and then she'll sign it. And that hasn't happened yet.
I think kind of what we've gotten from the administration and from people is that this project, especially with the AS Cafe that we're collaborating with, is that they perceive it as a lot of risk. But I think that we feel like the student body really is for this type of project, and is really something that the student body wants to see on campus, like a center for sustainable food, a center where they can come and like not only learn about things, like it's not enough just to say like this is what's sustainable, but for them to actually get involved. And so monetarily, financially, it is a big risk and a big investment, but I guess it's our goal right now to show administration that this project is not only what they should be funding and what they should be backing, but also that the project is legitimate and will be successful.
Since the beginning of February when this process started, there's kind of been this movement where there's been Student Food Collective over here and Associated Students over here on either side, and slowly but surely, but actually rather quickly, those 2 things kind of married together into what's now known as the IB Thought for Food Project. So that combines the goals of the cart and cafe together into one project. And over the course from February until about a month ago, all of the lease negotiations were gone into for the 6521 Pardal Road space, which is where Dirty's Barbecue used to be, to go through the initial process of getting legislative council to approve the funding, which was a total of $250,000 that they approved initially, and then in terms of signing the initial lease agreements, but then going through the due diligence process in terms of inspections on the building, both seismically, zoning-wise, just doing general inspection of the building for health code regulations and things like that. So that whole process has already been undergone. There are extensive reports by third-party brokers and
inspectors,
Associated Students, attorneys that speak to the, you know, the viability of this space, and that while it has been uncovered that there are certain issues that are minor in terms of, you know, minor health code inspections, issues, things like that, that the building has no major structural problems, it has no major issues. There's nothing that appears from all of these reports to be something that's unresolvable or kind of ending the process. So
no major setback. What kind of history does AS have with handling a sort of project where they're going to be in charge of a building?
AS provided the initial seed money for the Isla Vista Food Co-op, which is a somewhat different thing. That was more of a loan, if you will. Also, the Associated Students Bike Shop is another example of a AS-run business that's been extremely successful. And, you know, I think that's the whole point of this, is that we're trying to open this, like, as a social business that's designed to provide the greatest social good and not necessarily designed to generate the greatest profit. It will generate a profit, ideally, but it will be a marginal profit. I think that that's one of the issues that the chancellor has, is that, frankly, there's not much precedent in America for, you know, associated students organizations running food operations. But that's where we're committed and understand that we are going to have to hire a general manager, an executive chef, or somebody that does have experience that can come in and advise and get the project off the ground.
How do you guys envision the structure of the people working there?
So Wet Student Food Collective, we were like the group that kind of provided the vision for the food aspect of the cafe. But what Associated Students had hoped to do with the property was like a lot more. They wanted to incorporate that into like, or to make it into like a student space that could be venues for like live music. Groups could meet there, movie screens, potentially wine and cheese pairings. There was like a wide array of what, of different things people had hoped to put in that building. But it's serving food was a main priority, and that's kind of like where Student Food Collective, and we provided that vision, whereas like, you know, all of Associated Students' input was used to kind of shape what could be there or what could have been there, I guess.
I guess what I'm interpreting your question as is how will we structure and manage like as a cooperative? And so the Isla Vista Food Cooperative is different because they're autonomous, more autonomous than what our current plan is. But we envision the cafe and the cart operating as a student-run, democratically owned enterprise where anyone who buys into or works there, we're still working out the details of whether we want it to be a consumer cooperative or a worker cooperative. But basically, the concept is that you buy in or you work there, and you have an equal say in the management decisions, whether it be the hours where you're open, the food we serve, where it's sourced, what the educational components of the establishment are. So it's really the management will serve the purpose of getting people engaged in the campus food system and really be involved in the business that we hope to establish.
Once the cafe has been started, is it going to be run through dining services?
No, so that's...
Who will be doing like hiring and firing in that case?
Associated Students.
And SFC.
It would likely be that the general manager, whoever that is, that gets hired for that position would be in charge of the day-to-day operations of this organization. You know, you can't have a 9-member board vote on every ingredient. So there'd be a large level of autonomy of the day-to-day operations from a general manager, but then this cafe advisory committee, which the general manager would sit on most likely, would provide the framework for those larger decisions to be made and would be the liaison throughout the community and campus.
Let's say for some reason you didn't get the cafe, would you still, like, is the cart going through no matter what at this point?
Yes.
Yeah, so the Green Initiative Fund grant proposal that we have submitted shows that the cart on its own is a viable cooperative business. And so that was the plan from the beginning, to have that cart be a starting point. And so regardless of whether the cafe happens at the same time, we do think that the cart is its own viable business.
So the ideal would be to have the cart be like a sort of mobile arm of the cafe,
right,
and have like this visible, intimate relationship between the two.
Thank you, Student Food Collective, for talking with me. I'm just going to summarize up some of the main points from that interview. The Student Food Collective is a student-run organization that's trying to get a sustainable food cart on campus as an alternative to the fast food that already exists on the campus. And as of now, they have received some funding for the food cart, and they are in talks with Associated Students to actually open a storefront as well, which would potentially be located on the 6-5 block of Pardal, although those talks are still underway and there's some more to be done. For right now, Student Food Collective is working as a catering company and has been catering many events around the campus and community. So they are already in somewhat of a working stage, and more will be known very soon. Hi, my name is Chelsea Lorenz, and today I'm here with Vanessa, the Adopt-A-Block supervisor, and her assistant, Renee, and we will be discussing what the Isla Vista Adopt-A-Block program does to help keep Isla Vista clean. Can you both describe a little bit about what Adopt-A-Block is doing around Isla Vista?
So Adopt-A-Block has been around since 1996. Since then, Adopt-A-Block, the program, has collected over 1.3 million pounds of trash. The program is in existence because we want to prevent trash from going into the storm drains, draining into our ocean. And we're a very eco-friendly program, and essentially that's what we do. Right. So we have one of our largest events is that our Halloween cleanup, and we pick up thousands of pounds of trash around the time of Halloween. So this year we did the cleanup before Halloween and after Halloween, which is a huge undertaking, and we do a raffle with sponsors, and it's a lot of fun. We had over 500 people come out this year to help clean up, which is great, and we're also very involved in spring move out.
Yeah, and just like in a community like Isla Vista, I mean, there's so many students, and then there's all these families, and we always have a lot of community members going to trash cans, and then they'll leave things out, and plus all of the partying that happens around here inevitably. Like, it's just really, really important that we have this program where it involves the community so that students recognize how much, like, their actual just everyday things of just, you know, littering and leaving these things out actually adds up, and it creates a lot of trash. And especially when we live next to the ocean, it's just so, so important that we continue to have these kinds of programs. And so while we beautify the streets by picking up all the trash, we also try to beautify all the buildings and public property and everything by removing the graffiti.
How often do you guys have Adopt-A-Block? Is it daily?
It's daily. And then we have events as well. We have a lot of sororities and fraternities that come into us and say, hey, we'd love to host a cleanup this weekend. We've got 50 people. And I say, okay, here's a sign-in sheet. Here's supplies. Host the cleanup. Let me know how much trash you guys picked up. And we enter it in our logs. We're also really about, I would say, education. We want to educate our volunteers on why it's important. So when they're picking up trash, we also say, hey, if you see recyclables, please recycle them. Don't just toss them away. And unfortunately, what we're finding in the Isla Vista community is not a lot of residents that rent really care about the community. So after there's been a big party, you know, everything's left out in the driveway, the lawn area, no one takes care of it. So behind the scenes, essentially, we take care of everything.
So on an average day, not right after the weekend, is there still a good deal of trash?
Absolutely. There's a ton.
What sort of supplies do you give people when they're going out to do Adopt-A-Block?
Buckets and grapplers.
And then if people want to do, like, cleanups on the weekends, if it's a big sorority or whatnot, then we'll give them a bunch of bags and gloves, and then they can just go out on their own.
And we'd rather not do that because of recycling and plastic bags and everything else, but at the same time, it's for a really good cause, and so that's why we do it. But day-to-day, buckets and grapplers are only used.
How do you go about getting rid of the graffiti? Because that seems like kind of a large undertaking.
Yeah, so I'll just go out weekly and, you know, cruise through all the different streets, and sometimes I'll have all the supplies with me on hand so that I can just clean it immediately right when it's there. And it's really nice, too, because we have a good team of community service workers right now that'll help me do a lot of the dirty work, scrubbing and stuff, because it gets really, really tiresome when you have to constantly scrub and scrub and scrub. So, yeah, I'll go out and record all of the graffiti in a little log that I enter into the computer, and then I'll also take pictures of all of it because it really helps when they actually get caught.
We've been working really closely with Foot Patrol. Really closely, and we have had a few artists that have been caught. One of them owes the district $16,000 and was given 500 hours of community service by the DA's office. There's two more that were caught just about 2 weeks ago. So they do take it really seriously, and it creates a lot of work for our district.
So
no one else is taking care of it but us. Yeah. I mean, we contact, Renee contacts homeowners, and then they take care of it. It's just one of those things where it's a lot of work. I mean, I never could run the program and do all the graffiti removal. That's why Renee helps so much.
Then when you guys do your daily cleanups, is it, you know, a different street a week, a different section a week, or is it just kind of go where you can?
I go out quite a bit, like a couple days a week, and look at what areas are the worst, and I record them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I come in the office, I send people out wherever needs to be picked up. And I would say we do, I mean, several streets a day. So it's not, there isn't a constant program, because someone could have had a party on Abrego one night and DP the other night, and you're all spread out. And if you had a set program, this program wouldn't work because it doesn't really operate like that.
On average, how many volunteers are helping out each day?
Each day, including our community service workers, I would say we have
it 10. It varies. Yeah, like, I'd say 10.
10 probably a day. That's like a rough estimate. And the reason I'm giving you a rough estimate is because sometimes in the weekends we have a group come clean up and there's 20 to 75 people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think 10 a day is a pretty safe number.
And if someone wanted to get involved, how would they go about doing that?
They would email cleaniv@ivyparks.org or call our office, Adopt a Block Line, which is 968-2017 extension 24.
Cool.
Or you can always just drop by the office. We're open Monday through Friday, 9 to 5.
Do you guys have anything else you want to talk about while I'm here?
I would just like to remind people to recycle. It's very important, and it makes our job a lot easier.
My name is Chelsea Lorenz, and today I'm here with Ryland King, the founder of Environmental Education for the Next Generation, and we'll be talking about everything they've been doing to help the youth of the county.
So, Ryland, how did this project come about?
So back when I was a freshman, I got involved with the Environmental Affairs Board and with the EVPLA office at Associated Students. And I was given a grant from the EVPLA office and got really involved with the Environmental Education Campaign at the Environmental Affairs Board. And we went into one classroom and taught some curriculum that we would create each week. We would create a new lesson, and we would go into Ivy Elementary and teach in their second grade classroom. And I thought the program was so beneficial for not only the students that we taught, but for myself and for the college-age instructors that went and taught the kids, that I wanted to expand it to another school. So I used the money that I was given from the EVPLA office and went and expanded it to a whole new school at Adams Elementary. From there, the summer after my freshman year, I had a really great job at home as a director of a surf camp and learned a bunch of managerial, financial, leadership skills, and got kind of pointed in the right direction to found it as a nonprofit organization because I wanted to expand it a lot further. And after a lot of hard work, we find ourselves where we are now.
How many schools are you actually teaching in at this point?
So over the past 18 months since we were founded, we've expanded from one classroom in one school to 24 classrooms in 12 schools. And we've also just founded a regional chapter up at San Luis Obispo. So we have a whole leadership crew up there running the program at Cal Poly. And they actually just went into classrooms on April 1st. So they're running in a couple schools up there as well.
How did you get involved with Cal Poly on this?
So it was a lot of luck, but I like to keep it within the family, and I think there's too many connections in the world for us to outsource to people that we don't know. So we have a group of about 65 volunteer instructors, so I'm in really close contact with everyone on the team, and I asked people if they knew of somebody who would fit the mold really well to be our regional director up at Cal Poly, and I got a couple people's names and sent out some emails, and then held a few interviews with some people and picked the person that would fit best. And it ended up that her name's Jamie Kern, and she fits perfect. She's done all our graphic design and kind of remarketed the whole organization and just done an amazing job putting together teams and getting them into classrooms sooner than we had already expected. So it's been a great, great expansion.
Is there a way that you go about choosing which schools to approach with this idea?
When we started, it was pretty much just cold turkey and put together an outreach packet that would have our unit outlines. So we teach in first and second grade classrooms, and we would give our unit outlines to the teachers, and then they would take a read through them, and we'd explain what we would do and how we would do it. And then they would give us an email back and say we're interested, and we'd set up a time and date and then get five instructors ready to go and place them in the classroom because the time with the teacher worked with the time of their daily schedule. And now basically what's happened over the past 12 months or so is we've expanded just through word of mouth of teachers. The way we really get into new schools has just been people being interested. We haven't had to do too much outreach, which is really amazing. And it's just kind of grown by itself because of the benefits of the program for all the different publics that are involved.
So you guys utilize a teaching method known as flow learning. Can you quickly explain what that means?
Yeah, so I'm really involved with their education team, which is headed by a recent graduate, Hannah Wright. We decided to use a teaching style called flow learning, which has been produced by Joseph Cornell, which is known for nature mentoring or educating. We kind of wanted to bring that into the classroom. What it has to do with is it hits on all the different learner types as described by the format system. So we take the kids in the classroom and we get them excited with a part that we call awaken enthusiasm. And then we take them and we begin to focus their attention with the part that we call focus attention. And then we give them some type of activity or experiment or project to do, which we'll call the direct experience. And then after they finish all that up, we bring the whole class back together and they get to share what they learned with each other throughout the day in the closing inspiration. And within all that, we've also had to implement more school type functions because we are in the classroom and we're not outside, so we can't do total nature mentoring. So we've also implemented a thing that we like to call fun sheets. And they basically, we have to do worksheets when we were in school, but what our education team came up with was, why call them worksheets? They should be called fun sheets. So we produced a fun sheet that goes along with each lesson, and it reviews the concepts that the kids learned about throughout the lesson before, and they fill out the different words that need to be placed in different areas and then get to color it together. And then at the end of the 8-week program, we take all their fun sheets, put them together, and they get a cover page, and they get to take them home, and those are called their nature journals. So they get to show that off to their parents and family and friends.
Can you describe the curriculum of the classes? How did you decide what topics to cover in the class?
Yeah, so our education team has been working really hard over the past 18 months to develop what we now have as our environmental science and sustainability program. Our first graders learn about environmental science, so things that we would consider natural systems, such as habitats, ecosystems, things that when we go into the classroom with first graders, they learn by seeing things hands-on. And when we go into second grade, they are really starting to be introduced into more abstract concepts. So we wanted to really relate what we're going to teach the kids to what they would really be learning in the classroom if we weren't there. So with our second graders learning more about abstract concepts, we take them into the subject of sustainability. And we begin to teach them about water conservation and how to turn your lights off before you leave a room, those type of things where they can change their daily habits. And when they go out and change their daily habits and kind of encourage their friends and family to do that too, I think it's going to make a big change in the community as a whole. When kids are informed and excited about a topic, it's really inspiring for older people to see that happening and go about making those changes themselves.
Yeah. How do you actually keep the children focused? Because they're first and second graders. I know when I was in first and second grade, I was running around and the teachers were making me sit on red lines outside lunch.
We're all about engagement. So we run our program in a small group model. So when we walk into the class, we have our five college instructors that go in as a team. Before they go in, they set up the whole lesson with each other. So they do a visualization run through and they know who's going to be running which part of the lesson. And when they get in the class, they introduce the subject topic, and then they break off into what we call our nature teams. So each instructor has a nature team of about five students. So we're taking it from a regular public school day where they have classrooms running with one teacher and 30 students to a classroom that's now going to run with one teacher for every five students. And in those small groups, we're able to engage those students a lot more than they would be engaged in their regular school day. We've actually found that teachers have come up to us or Tanya Haravian, our director of operations, and let her know that I'm so happy with the small group model that's in the classroom because the kids that are left behind during the regular school days are now engaged and are learning and are taking the concepts in and internalizing them, where during their regular school day, they're kind of left behind and don't really get to internalize those concepts that are taught during the regular school day. So it's a whole new game that we kind of offer into the classroom, and I think it really helps to keep the kids excited and informed.
Do each of the nature teams learn the same thing throughout the day, or do they all learn something different and come back together and share what they've...
No, so all the nature teams will learn the same thing. So it's one lesson that's based off a focusing question, and by the end of the lesson, we want all those students in the classroom to be able to answer that focusing question and hopefully beyond what that focusing question asks.
Right. And you guys, you only have college students teaching them, and as I learned from your website, eengonline.org, you do that for a reason. Can you explain that real quick?
Along with the small group model, we love how we are able to offer youth-to-youth connection. I think that bringing a higher people that are going to higher education institutes into a classroom with first and second graders is really important. There's so many kids in elementary schools today that don't have somebody around them that's in a college or somebody around them that is excited about education. And we're all at UCSB because we're excited to learn and want to further our knowledge of the different subjects that we're concentrating on. So to bring the 18 to 22 year olds, which not only are just the coolest people in the world, to 6 through 8 year old kids, but are people who have a love for learning and can pass that on to 6 to 8 year old children is so important for our kids to have. And I think that more schools, elementary schools that surround a university, need to start to harness that potential and start to connect with the university, because there's so many programs that are just being cut because of budget cuts that have gone over the past two or three years, and we need more opportunities for our college students to really get out in the real world and get some experience in doing that stuff. So it's beneficial for both parties to have us in there, not just the youth-to-youth mentorship that the students receive, but also the resume building experience that our instructors get by going into the classroom, working on team-based, working on a team and having public speaking experience in front of 30 little heads and getting in and becoming a teacher. I know a lot of people want to become a teacher when they graduate, and this is a great way to kind of get that career started.
That actually brings up two questions. First of all, are you one of the people that wants to be a teacher when you graduate? Because you seem really enthusiastic about this.
Yeah. I think when I get older, I'd like to be a teacher. I think there's nothing more important or nothing more fulfilling for me than being able to affect somebody else's life, especially in a positive way. And I could definitely see myself becoming a teacher one day, but right now my focus is on what we're doing with environmental education for the next generation and expanding that as far as we can go. So that's where I am now.
Okay, and then the other question that brought up is, you were talking about how some, like, the college students are all different majors. Does that actually factor in to the program, having different majors? Does it help the program?
Totally, yeah. I think that having people from every different major is of utmost importance. If you look into the environmental science or environmental studies department here, it's one of the broadest disciplines at a school or at any school. So if we're going to go in and teach environmental science or sustainability, we want to have all those different views coming together in a classroom. If you think about in the environment, that comes down from politics to engineering, all the way to anything that can just be as inspirational as art. So we want to bring that into the classroom and share that with those kids. But beyond just having the discipline connect with all the different subjects, the way people think, from being an art major to being a mechanical engineer major or a mathematician, is very different. And the way the 6 through 8 year old students think in the class is very different. There's a wide array of the way people learn. So bringing in those different types of majors into the classroom and connecting them through environmental science and through sustainability is really, really helpful, because those kids get to learn from an art major, which can connect better with them, or they can learn from somebody who's a math major and they can connect better with them.
So Ryland, there's been a lot of uproar about this Dockers competition on Facebook. Can you tell me a little bit about that, and then also what the final judgment was?
Yeah, so basically we entered into Dockers Wear the Pants contest and went up against over 3,300 other entries. We got selected into the top 50 because we were in the top 50 votes from those 3,300 applicants from the top 50, I wrote a grant, and our team and myself created a video, and then Docker's officials selected us into the top 5. And then once we got put in the top 5, it was announced and put out, and it was up to a Facebook vote to select the winner for $100,000. And we had a big campaign that we ran through Facebook and actually went ahead and won it. So that came out and was announced, and we're just elated and super excited to get things underway.
Cool. Do you guys have any huge plans for that $100,000?
Yeah, we're planning to expand next year. The plan is to expand into 3 new cities, one in fall, one in winter, and one in spring. And we're vetting regional chapters in San Francisco, San Diego, Santa Cruz, and Los Angeles. So we'll pick 3 from those 4, and we'll see where we go from there.
So, now that you guys have won, I mean, it seems like your whole idea of getting this statewide is really underway. Do you have any plans for future funding, I mean, to keep this momentum going?
Without a doubt. The main goal from getting this $100,000 is to have it be able to sustain us after we finish using it. So once we finish up with $100,000, we want to make sure that we're able to get some type of sustained funding from a foundation or from the public that's going to keep us going and hopefully expand us beyond statewide, which is the main goal of the organization.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to bring up today?
Thank you so much for everybody who came out and voted. That was a ton of fun, and I appreciate it so much. We're going to keep it going for all you guys. Thank you.
My name is Chelsea Lorenz, and today I'm here with Kyle and James from the UCSB Renewable Energy Governance Board.
For those listeners who don't know, can you tell us what the Renewable Energy Governance Board does?
The Renewable Energy Governance Board is a group of students, faculty, and staff that are working to manage the Renewable Energy Initiative Fund and look at project any kind of renewable energy projects on campus and make some decisions about how we will spend the money from the Renewable Energy Initiative.
And James, can you tell me a little bit about the lock-in fee that did occur for the Renewable Energy Initiative?
Yeah, definitely. So Clay Carlson and Michael Hewitt, who graduated just last year, Michael Hewitt was on Legislative Council last year, Associate Students, and Clay Carlson was the External Vice President for Local Affairs. They both got together and basically campaigned on this lock-in fee that went on the spring ballot in 2010. Basically, it provided $440 in student fees to go to renewable energy projects over the next 10 years, and that added up to about, I believe it's $3.4 million over 10 years. And yeah, like Kyle was saying, the Renewable Energy Initiative Governance Board is set up to implement those fees and create renewable energy projects across the campus.
So the first project you guys are working on has to do with solar panels on the roof of parking structure 22. Can you tell me a little bit about the project and what you guys have done on it so far, I guess?
Yeah, so the parking structure 22 was actually originally designed to have a solar array. When they built it a few years ago, it was designed this way, so it has piping in place and everything in case someone wanted to come on and do this. And they actually had a smaller system designed before the Renewable Energy Initiative was passed. But since these funds have been approved and there's this money generated that goes towards renewable energy projects on campus, Student Affairs has taken it to another level and with the support of the students and really put it into this big project. And it's a $2 million project and will produce a significant amount of electricity, and our job was to look at how big should we make this project.
After a lot of discussion on the matter, this probably took over the course of 10 meetings at least, the governance board made a decision to split up the project into 2 parts. The array on parking structure 22, there's a center array, and then there's an east and west array. The east and west array is flat. We're trying to get it a little bit tilted for maintenance reasons, but those are essentially flat, and the center array is going to be tilted at about 10 degrees. And so a lot of the concern among the members of the board was over the cost of the project. Basically, with the entire array, it would be about $4 million. But it's important to note that the $4 million wouldn't just be coming from the Renewable Energy Initiative, but I can get into that a little bit later. So we decided to split up the project into 2 parts. So the center array would go out for bid because the university basically, as a public university, we have to put everything out to public bid. The center array bid is going to be about $3 million. So that doesn't include the east and west part of the array. And with the east and west, it adds about $1 million onto that. So essentially, we're waiting for the whole bid process to go through. And then once that happens, it's going to be up to the governor's board to decide whether they want to just do the center array or do the whole thing. And it's going to be a question of cost and how competitive the prices are that all the construction companies are coming back with.
Okay, so I have two questions. The first one being, you were saying not all of the money is coming from the Renewable Energy Initiative Fund, so where else is the money coming from?
So a lot of it depends on the size of the project, especially for the Southern California Edison rebates. Essentially, there's the Student Resource Building Governance Board, which is pledged to give $750,000, irregardless of the size of the project. Then the Southern California Edison rebates for the whole project size would be about $600,000. And since the Renewable Energy Initiative, it's a lock-in fee, so we're getting money every quarter as opposed to $3 million all up front. So the Student Affairs has agreed to give us a loan over the course of the project at 0% interest, because they're benefiting from this too. So we'll be paying back every quarter about $300,000 to them, but the project will be able to go ahead in the near future.
Where is this energy planned to go to?
The parking structure PV array will be located right next to the Student Resources Building. And the plan is basically to take the energy generated from the PV array and use it to offset all of the energy consumed at the Student Resources Building to reduce that energy bill.
So the larger idea behind the ballot initiative was this idea called Zero Net Energy. Essentially, we want to reduce Student Affairs' utility budget by as much as possible, so they're paying less to the electric companies and they can put more money towards student services. And a part of that is renewable energy generation, because with any building, you can only do so much with efficiency and behavioral changes. So somehow you have to actually produce your energy on site to actually get off the grid. So we're trying to get, I think the idea is that we get about 25 to 30% from renewable energy generation, which the Renewable Energy Initiative will be supporting. And then about 30% from efficiency adjustments, and then the rest from behavioral changes. So we're sort of one part of the equation, but Student Affairs is aggressively tackling the other parts too.
Just to add to that, I think one of the things that's important about this project is it will be highly visible. And in the past, it was the campus actually didn't want these projects to be visible. Like, they actually ran into some problems with the Recreation Center project, and they actually wanted to spend this extra money to build a wall around it so you wouldn't be able to see it. But it's getting to the point now where having these projects on campus is important, and it's kind of just really sends a message of sustainability, and it can actually be used to help the other pieces of the puzzle too. Just having the PV array really visible on this parking structure, and there will actually be a kiosk where you can see the energy that is produced and potentially other buildings, and see, and you can compare the usage of the buildings with the energy generated, just to kind of get a better idea of what kind of issues there are. So to get a better idea of how much energy is being used on campus and how students can work towards saving energy as well.
Yeah, and I know for a fact that at the beginning of the year there was a lot of push from the administration and people in Student Affairs to actually get this project finished by the end of this year, which wasn't exactly realistic, but the whole idea was that they want to have it up by commencement because it's such a good publicity component for UCSB, and it really enhances our notoriety.
So what else are you guys planning in the future as other projects?
I mean, really, there's nothing on the docket right now because this is pretty much consumed, this one project, because it's so big and so expansive, it's pretty much consumed all our energy for the governance board this year. So, and a big focus of Kyle and I's, I think, has been that we want this project not to use up all the funds for the lock-in fee over the whole 10 years, because we think it's really important that other students have the chance to implement projects of their own in the coming years. So I think it's really important to emphasize that how much of an opportunity we have
in the future to really enhance our efforts.
At UCSB, there's a lot of open space, a lot of potential sites, and really the only issue has been that no one has the funding to take advantage of that. You know, there is a lot of opportunities in different roof spaces. I think there's a lot of opportunities, and one of the issues was we want to be able to keep money for the coming years so that we can keep implementing these new projects. And so we're actually trying to work out something where some of the revenue generated from the systems will be used to fund future projects. So create kind of this self-sustaining funding mechanism.
If you were a fish or a seagull, what might this look like? What do you think? Okay, do you want to go?
A turtle might eat it.
Yeah, fish and birds eat this stuff.
That was just a clip from an Art from Scrap class recorded at their Watershed Resource Center. And now, here's an interview with Jill Cloutier, one of their staff members, and she will be talking about what Art from Scrap does around town. Jill, can you tell the listeners who may not yet know what Art from Scrap is and how it helps the Santa Barbara community reduce waste?
Okay, so Art from Scrap is an environmental education nonprofit. It's 20 years old this year, and Art from Scrap is in the business of waste diversion through its reuse store. So it has this giant store filled to the rafters, I don't know if you went, with stuff that otherwise would have gone to the landfill. So things like PAL skateboard wheels, they make skateboard and scooter wheels in Santa Barbara. Instead of throwing them into a dumpster, which would then go to the landfill and sit there forever, they bring them to Art from Scrap, or we pick them up, and then people make art out of them. People use them for costumes for summer solstice. We also have fabric from Patagonia. When borders closed, we got a lot of their stuff. So we basically divert waste from the landfill through the reuse store. And then the bigger part of Art from Scrap is also the Environmental Education Center. And we teach classes to over 10,000 students a year. We teach classes Creek Kids, Watershed Education, Waste Reduction, Gardening, Composting, Organic Gardening. And then we also manage the Watershed Resource Center at Hendry's Beach, where we teach about watershed education and how our actions on the land affect water quality.
How many schools actually take part in that educational program?
More than 200 Santa Barbara County schools and youth organizations like Fun in the Sun or Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts have benefited from our program.
Are there certain grades that you cater your programs to, or is it all of elementary school, mm-hmm. middle school?
It's usually K through 8th grade, and we do have programs for adults as well. We recently taught a worm composting class at two of them in the past couple months. So we're cool. Kind of broadening our outreach to adults because a lot of people are interested in so-called green movement.
Like you said, you have classes at both the Art from Scrap building as well as the Watershed Resource Center, which is at the Arroyo Burro Beach County Park. How do you tailor the program so that they teach different things to the children and adults who go there?
Yeah, so we do go into classrooms and we teach Creek Kids classes, which we would go to the class for two. We do in class for two lessons. One lesson, we take them to the Watershed Resource Center. Okay. So they learn all about watershed education and how their actions on land affect the water. Then we go back to their school for another lesson. During that watershed field trip, they also go to a creek that's close to their school, so they can kind of have ownership and pride in their watershed, in their land. And then the classes we teach at Art from Scrap, the building downtown where the reuse store is, we include an art segment in that. We teach about waste diversion and waste reduction, recycling, reuse, the four R's, rethink is one of them too. And then we do an art component where they use the reused materials to make art. So we do kind of tailor it to the location.
I actually was in a class my freshman year mm-hmm. where an Art from Scrap spokeswoman came in and she was talking about what you all do, and she brought a lot of examples of art projects that have happened. The projects she brought into our class were actually done by a local artist. Do you sell projects like that, or how does that work?
Well, once a week, local artists will come. They'll be the guest instructor and we have art workshops every Saturday from 10 to 12. And this has been going on for years and years and years. And local artists will come in and make projects with children and adults, depending on the topic. Like mm-hmm. we'll do shrines maybe which the kids sometimes will come. Or we'll do, I think this week it's exquisite bugs. So the artists will come in, and that's probably where the samples came from. Cool. We do also have the AFS Gallery, which I forgot to mention earlier, which is above the store, and we have shows, rotating shows throughout the year, probably maybe 6 to 7 a year. and where a lot of the material is, it's assemblage art, which is using found materials. So that's another way to show the power of using reused materials in art.
Do you know the background of how this company came to be?
This was before my time there, but some parents were, I think, frustrated and concerned about the lack of art instruction and art classes in the schools. And so they started kind of, I think, just gathering reused material for art in one of their garages, or a couple garages, and then they needed a bigger space for all the material they were gathering. So then they moved to a hangar out in Goleta, actually close to UCSB, and then decided they wanted to bring it downtown. And so, yeah, it started from concerned parents who wanted to make sure their children had art in their lives.
Like you said, you also teach gardening classes. How exactly do those take shape?
What we do is we go to schools, we will help them set up a composting system using worms, worm bins, which is always fun with the kids. They love it. And then we will help them kind of design a garden or give input into helping them start the garden. We also offer workshops in organic gardening and composting. So 82 schools have participated in Green Schools composting lessons. So composting lessons are a big part of what we're doing, especially now that the city of Santa Barbara has started the food scraps program. So we're kind of working with them to teach kids about how they can compost their food scraps at school.
Can you explain the difference between worm composting versus composting just using heat?
So in the worm bin, it's a closed container. You can keep it inside if you want. I have mine outside. And you employ the microorganisms to turn your garbage into something very valuable. So you basically have a closed container, you fill it with worms. We call it worm culture because along with the worms come roly-polies and little mites and beetles, bacteria, fungi, and you put your food scraps in the bin and they will eat or through their enzymes turn your garbage into compost. So it's really kind of a cool thing. I tell the kids we're kind of recreating a forest floor in your worm bin.
When you go to these classes and have them learn about composting, have them learn about the gardens, do they utilize what they compost on the gardens, or if there's excess, is there some place in Santa Barbara where they take their composted materials?
Most of the teachers, I believe, use them in the school gardens because school gardens are really, a lot of the schools have them now, which is great. And then there are those few teachers who forget about the worms, and then they come back the next year to it.
How long have you been at Art from Scrap?
I've been there for 4.5 years.
And have there been any, like, standout moments that really inspired you or touched you in some way?
Well, I would say the kids, like, my friends and I will be walking, the other educators will be walking across town, and one little girl held up a reusable water bottle and said, "Chill!" And, you know, you see hundreds of them, yeah. And it's like, "Hi, I bought this." That was one. And then a little boy after we showed, I don't know if you saw the video of the plastic in the ocean,
right.
And Algalita Marine Research Foundation's video, this little boy at the end of the video, it shows birds with plastic in their stomach, and it's pretty dramatic, all the plastic in the ocean versus plankton. And he raised his hand, he said, "Well, I guess I don't love my Legos like I thought I did, because they're plastic." It was really cute.
Yeah.
So it was great he made that connection between his toys and all this plastic out in the ocean. So there's been many, many instances. You get thank you notes from them all the time. And it's great. Kids are just really open and want to help.
Yeah, and I think that teaching children, you know, they bring that back to their families, they bring that to their friends, and it really ends up teaching more than just the person that you intended to teach to begin with.
And the thing we have to try and figure out is how to get high school age students, because I think they're really into picking up trash, and then junior high and high school, they start littering again. And I've always tried to figure out what's going on with that.
The AFS Reuse Store has some statistics. Do you want to go over those real quick?
Sure. So the AFS Reuse Store has diverted from the Tahiguas landfill over the past 20 years about 250 tons, and that's 500,000 pounds of potential trash. And we're always looking for businesses to work with because this is our goal, and we really want to divert waste.
When companies do want to contact you about waste, is there a certain type of waste that you take and a certain type that, you know, maybe even you can't really utilize?
Yeah, we take all sorts of things. We have fabric, ceramic, the skateboard wheel shavings that I was talking about, jewelry from jewelry companies. I think the best thing to do is, I may not be the right person to talk to about that, so I would contact Cherise and ask her directly. But we will take a lot of a diverse array of items.
Well, thank you so much for meeting with me. I know you guys are doing awesome stuff over Santa Barbara, and I'm really inspired by what you guys are doing. So,
well, thank you.
I would just like to take this time to really thank all of the great environmental organizations we have throughout Santa Barbara. There are those we talked to today, Environmental Education for the Next Generation, the Renewable Energy Governance Board, Student Food Collective, Art from Scrap, the Isla Vista Adopt-A-Block Program, and there are just so many others, the Community Environmental Council, the Environmental Defense Center. We have a great program or a great organization called Lowetry that just tries to link up different environmentally conscious groups so that they can work together, and just so many more. And I'd just like to really take the time to appreciate them. If you guys have any questions about anything that you've heard today, please call in at 805-893-2424. I will do my best to answer your questions. And next week, we will be discussing automobiles as well as oil. And I believe we'll be discussing a little bit about marine ecosystems as well. So yeah, if you're interested in those topics, next week, 6 to 7 a.m., Green Radio. Thank you so much for listening.